So brothers in the Dharma, with loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. In harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination. For the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. For the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. So these are the verses of acceptance, sometimes called the four ordination vows, that happen towards the end of the public ordination ceremony. They're recited by the people, or the person being ordained, after they've received their white kesa. They take these verses, they take these vows, and I think the verses, I don't remember taking them at my own public ordination, but being a public preceptor, of course, you get to know the ceremony from a different perspective. And when I first started to do public ordinations, I was very, very struck and moved by these verses, and in giving them, they really did feel like vows. They had a kind of solemnity and gravity to them at that point in the ceremony, after the bestowal of the pure white kesa with the flaming three jewels emblazoned on it. Quite a moment. And I remember very soon after my public ordination giving talks on these four verses, because they seemed so significant, they seem to represent to me the spirit with which ordination in the Triratna is given, and the spirit with which it's received. That's what these verses seem to really evoke in the ceremony. So my duty this evening is to talk about with loyalty to my teachers, but I'd like to just talk about more generally about the ordination ceremony. So you've got a sort of sense of where they come from. Of course, the ordination ceremony has two parts. What's called the private ordination, followed by the public ordination. They're not two separate ordinations. This is incredibly important to understand. They are two aspects of one ordination. You can't have a private ordination without a public ordination. You can't have a public ordination without a private ordination. Very important to remember that and not to misunderstand, especially the nature of the private ordination. That's not a sort of a justification for individualism. That will happen before the public ordination. And in that private ordination, you go alone to your private preceptor. Of course, you would have asked somebody to be your private preceptor probably some years beforehand. And you go alone. And Bhante's vision of the private ordination is that it symbolises the fact that you are willing to go it alone. You're willing to go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. You're willing to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all alone. Even if nobody else in the whole world is doing it, you still would. You would still do it. And in the course of the private ordination, it's a slightly different ceremony. It's got very similar elements, but of course it's got the giving of the mantra, your introduction to your own personal Buddha or Bodhisattva on which you're going to meditate every day, that embodiment of enlightenment, you at the end of the path that you meditate on regularly, representing the complete transformation of your entire being. And you're given your name by your private preceptor. And yes, it has this strong symbolism of willing to go it alone. I think it comes out of Bhante's own experience. Do you remember when he was in South India, mostly surrounded by very inspired Hindu teachers, but realizing his faith in Buddhism was even stronger, even though the Buddhists he'd met hadn't been particularly inspiring. They'd been quite obstructive in many ways, but he still wanted to go for refuge to the Buddha. And I've been thinking recently about this willingness to go it alone. It actually applies to life in the order itself. Sometimes, you know, the order that you're entering is not an order of bodhisattvas. It's maybe on a very good day, in the wind in the right direction, there might be a few bodhisattva moments. It's pretty good, but you might find yourself after you're ordained, maybe even before you're ordained, in a situation where you are the one who is really holding the values of the order, even though the other order members around might be quite senior, quite experienced. They might be sort of letting you down, letting the order down, letting the Dharma down, letting Bante down. You might be the one that has to stand up for the values of the order. You might have to proclaim the going for refuge and the practice of the precepts. That's what going it alone really means. It's not individualism. It's not selfishness. I have my own path. I have my own practice. I'm doing it my way. It's not individualism. It's quite different than that. It's holding the values of the order individually. Very, very important to understand this point. So the private ordination happens beforehand. But then, as Bhante says, yes, you're willing to go it alone, but then you, as it were, emerge into the light of the public ordination, realizing that you don't need to, because there are all these other individuals going for refuge who you can join with in harmony. And you can be publicly ordained. Your public ordination means that you are giving full expression to your going for refuge within the public reality, in relation to the rest of the order, in relation to the rest of the world. And it's your public preceptor who conducts your public ordination, who sees that, yes, you are indeed ready to be received into the order, ready to enter into the order. And I just very briefly mentioned the course of the public ordination, because it's something some of us have been thinking quite a lot recently, that the meaning of what we do as order members is actually found in our ceremonies. It's very easy to forget when you're an order member of what you've done. And I sometimes think it would be a very, very good idea within the order itself if we actually devoted more time to reflecting on what we've actually done. It's so easy to forget that there's a sort of anti-ceremonial kind of world in which we live, this highly secularizing world. But these ceremonies are of great weight, great power, for want of a better word. They're not to be played around with. Going for refuge, traditionally, the act of going for refuge ceremonially is regarded as a weighty karma. A weighty karma. I mean, in our order, it's a tremendously weighty karma, because we take it extremely seriously. I mean, you're doing all these retreats. We're spending a lot of time with you. So there's a lot of weight behind it. Well, you don't play around with that. And it's very interesting when people get into difficulties after their ordination, perhaps even start rejecting their ordination. It's a very painful time. It's a very, very painful time, because they've actually done something. They've invoked something. I've been reading recently various academic studies, quite well-written academic studies, I must say, about friendship rituals and brotherhood rituals in Christianity, in Eastern Christianity, Orthodox Christianity. And these are ceremonies done in the presence of the Eucharist. And in those times, in those days, this really meant something. You know, you don't play around with it. You don't play fast and loose with it. These are almost like blood oaths. Well, I think it's like that with our own ceremony. That's the way I feel about it. It's not empty, it's not dead, it's living. So yes, it's very important, I think, that we reflect on the actual ceremony itself. So in the public ordination ceremony, first of all, you make offerings. You offer flowers, lights, incense, taken from your preceptor, representing all of you offered up to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. That's what offering represents. Very simple, very beautiful, but really it represents you offering up everything and being receptive to the influence of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha as it comes through the experience of the order and your Kalyana Mitras and preceptors. Then you say a verse of purification. A lot of emphasis on purification in both the private and especially the public ordination ceremony. Being a Dhammachari, a Dhammacharini, is living a life of continuous purification. Purifying yourself of unskillfulness. Somebody noted in our group today, reading Subhuti's What is the Order talks, that he talks about purification of the power mode. Purification of the power mode. Purification into the love mode. That's what we're doing. And of course, as soon as we mention love mode and power mode, we're always looking at other people's power. Or we think they have power, rather than really looking at ourselves and the need for us to purify. So purification of body, speech and mind. And then you have to ritually ask for ordination. Yes, you ask for ordination a long time before, but in the ceremony it's to remind you that you want this individually. You ask in Pali, in the Pali words, which are then translated for you. But you are asking, you say to your preceptor, Bhante, you address your preceptor as Bhante. Bhante, I wish to take the three refuges together with the Dharmachari ordination vows. Kindly give them to me, Bhante. So this represents that you really want to do it. You're completely behind it. And this needs to be refreshed constantly, both before and after ordination. Do you really want this? It's well worth checking it out. Don't sort of, I was saying this morning in our group, don't harbour doubts thinking, oh, I'll sort that out after ordination. I'm interested in that teacher, that tradition, that other religion maybe, that approach to things. Do it now. Don't leave it after ordination. It'll be terribly confusing for you after ordination. Check out all the options so that when you ask, you are 100% behind this act of going for refuge, this act of ordination. And it's very interesting in the ceremony that the preceptor then says, repeat whatever I say. In other words, you put yourself in a totally receptive position in relation to the preceptor. He doesn't tell you at that moment what he's going to say, ask you to say, but he's just saying, well, you now have to repeat whatever I say. It could be anything, but actually what it is the refuges and then the precepts. It's a very, very powerful moment in the ceremony, a very powerful moment of the acknowledgement that the preceptor holds in that moment the refuges and the precepts for you. He's going to be witnessing that movement in you ceremonially. And yes, he gives the refuges, which is the very heart of the ceremony. It's going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha that defines us as an order, going for refuge on deeper and deeper, higher and higher levels in a wider and wider context. So this is a very, very important moment in the ceremony. A very, very moving moment. Recently I did a public ordination of a very old friend of mine, Jodi Pala, who actually resigned from the order 20 years ago but came back recently. In his case, we didn't need to do his private ordination again because his connection with Bhante was so strong and so alive. But doing the refuges with him was an extraordinary moment. I can't really describe it, but one really felt that there, something was happening. And then after that, there is more purification. You are ritually anointed with water on the crown of your head, which just reminds you, gives the sort of ritual reminder of purification, of the need for purification. Even some people say that, I've heard some order members say that that was one of the most powerful moments in their ceremony. They really felt that in that moment they were being purified, that there was this sort of nectar, coming in at the crown of their head and pervading their whole being. And then you're given the kesa. When the kesa goes on round your neck, that's it. You're ordained. You make the transition, and it's very, very noticeable. There's a real before and after, and a feeling, yes, actually this person really looks who they are now. They are where they're meant to be. And then after that, there are these acceptance verses, and then the giving of the name, and then there are blessings and sadhus, and a very, very positive atmosphere prevails. There's a tremendous release of energy, and you can feel it sort of spreading all around. Sometimes doing public ordinations here, when I first did them, and there were people who weren't even Buddhists present at the ceremony, I really had the feeling that an ordination was like the fourth sight. And people were very moved, even non-Buddhists were very moved, because they were seeing somebody enter a higher life. And they could really understand that and resonate with it and feel it. So that's how an ordination can be. That's how an ordination is. And yes, there is this sort of mixture, particularly at a public ordination, of solemnity, of depth, and real joy and lightness. And this sense of entering into this world which we call the order, the Tri Ratna order. The word for ordination, I think I just want to mention this just to bring out a bit more the sort of sense of depth of the ceremony. The word for ordination in the Buddhist tradition is Sambara. Sambara. And that's the word that's used in the Pali ritual verses of asking for ordination, and as well as being exhorted by your preceptor. The word sangvara means literally a binding. You're bound to the refuges, you're bound to the precepts, you're bound to the tradition of ordination that your preceptor is transmitting, bound in a very, very positive way, not bound in a sort of sense of holding you down or something like that. So it's more like this idea of a very, very deep bond, a very, very deep bond, something like an oath. It's like an oath. That's what it's really like. You get perhaps a similar idea in Tantric Buddhism, where they talk about samaya. Samaya means an oath or a bond that is established at the time of initiation between you and your teacher, you and the deity in which he's initiated you into. Well, it's like that with our ordination. It's very, very much like that, something very, very strong indeed. That's the way we're giving it. That's the way we transmit it. These are the kind of assumptions that we make. Because that's the way we've been trained. That's the way the tradition that we're coming out of from Sangharaksha, from Bhante. It's interesting, while we're on the word samaya, I was talking to, he's an ex-order member now, who got involved quite heavily in Tibetan Buddhism. And he told me that when he met Chatral Sangye Dorje, Bhante's first teacher, one of the greatest lamas of 20th century, 21st century, Chatral Rinpoche said that Bhante had always kept samaya with him. And apparently when an old lama talks like this, when a great lama talks like this, it really means something. In other words, Bhante had never broken that bond formed between him and Chatro Sangye Dorje. Presumably because Bhante had been completely faithful to him as his teacher, keeping him in mind all the time, practicing guru yoga, but also meditating on the bodhisattva that Chatro Rinpoche had initiated him into. Always keeping the samaya, always keeping the bond. So this brings us to the first of these acceptance verses. With loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. With loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. These verses, by the way, these acceptance verses were composed by Bhante himself. He developed the whole ordination ceremony, both private and public, out of traditional sources. They're based on traditional ordination patterns, but he's added to them things which give us a particular, you know, which really communicate his particular vision, translation of the Dharma, his particular experience of the Dharma. So with loyalty to my teachers is the first of these verses. Some might think, well, why isn't it enlightenment first? Surely it should be that first. But of course, Bhante himself is a very traditional Buddhist. Well, he's an interesting transitional figure. That's why I love this particular image of Bhante, because that's how he looked when I was ordained by him, wearing those yellow robes. And yet he's got long hair and beads, which shouldn't really go with bhikshu robes. It's a wonderful iconographic contradiction, a wonderful iconographic sort of symbol of, if you like, the transcendence of monk and lay, perhaps the transcendence of traditional and modern. Bhante is a sort of in-between figure. Very difficult, I think, for us to understand where he's come from and where he's come to. I think people try to box Bhante in, and I've had a fair bit of contact with Bhante, not as much as some, but a fair bit, and I don't think it's possible to do that. I don't think it's actually possible even to judge him. Certainly I've never done that myself. Where was I? So yes, I was saying he's a traditional figure in many ways, and of course within the tradition, of course your first expression of in this case of loyalty, and perhaps with that is gratitude and respect and even reverence and strength of connection, is going to be to your teachers, spiritual friends, your Dharma teachers. It's going to be in relation to them. This is very, very much the traditional way of looking at things, because it's your teachers who are really transmitting the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha to you. It's not, of course, that you don't have your own independent sort of sense of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, but really and truly your understanding of and your feeling for the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha comes through a whole chain, a whole lineage, a whole parampara, to use the Indian term, of teachers and friends. That's where it's coming from. It is very, very important to appreciate. I think in the modern world where we've got this view that we are so individual and independent and autonomous, it's a terrible slur to be accused of not being an individual. Of course, we're all group members. We are all group members in the West. We've just got more of a cool, sophisticated way of being group members. But you just have to look at people on their smartphones doing all their individual stuff to realise what a terrible kind of group we're involved with. So of course, first, yes, you express your loyalty. And like I say, with that, I think that goes, that you can't use all the words, is going to be gratitude and reverence and respect for your teachers, especially your preceptors, and especially their preceptors, and especially Bhante. That's what's going on with loyalty to my teachers. It's an expression of loyalty to the tradition in which you're being ordained into. I did ask Bounty, after I was started to do public ordinations, I said, well, you composed those verses, didn't you? Because, you know, these things he didn't necessarily explain to us. One of the things about Bounty, I think one of his geniuses as a teacher, is that he's sparked us off, he's instructed us, but he's also let us get on with things to kind of work it out for ourselves. Even make mistakes ourselves. He's been, you know, very, very good in that way. And, you know, he once said, you know, that you really start to learn when you start to teach. And, you know, he's been very keen for us to find out things, although he's given us a lot of instruction, but he hasn't micromanaged in any way. So I asked him, I said, well, what do you mean with loyalty to my teachers? And he said, he didn't say much. And I'm always a bit, it's always afterwards, I think, why didn't I ask that question? Why didn't I ask that question? A bit sort of spiritually thick. Spiritually thick, anyway. Thick in all sorts of ways. First thing he said was very interesting. Notice loyalty to, not faith in. And at the time, I didn't say, oh, well, what do you mean by that? So I went away and reflected on it. I think what he's getting at, it makes sense to me. You have faith in the Buddha. You have Shraddha for the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. You don't have, unless you're absolutely certain that your teacher is enlightened, you're not going to have Shraddha for your teacher. You may well have respect and reverence. You have loyalty, you have this bond. But I thought that was quite interesting because it seems to me that Bounty is making it clear that in relation to your teachers, yes, they're very important. Yes, there is a very strong bond. But you direct your faith, they want you to direct your faith at the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, not at them. I think this is tremendously important because they themselves are living from faith, are living from Shraddha, or they should be if they're in that sort of position. So loyalty to, not faith in. Maybe that could be a bit of a discussion point. And he said, it's good, isn't it, that I said teachers, plural. And of course, he was the only teacher and preceptor in the early days of the order when he composed these verses. In those days, we didn't talk about private and public preceptors. We didn't really talk about Bounty as a preceptor. It wasn't like that at all. It was just Bounty, and he ordained us. That's the way it was. It's very hard to kind of communicate what it was like in those days, because we didn't sort of look at things in those terms. There was Bounty, there was us, and Bounty did everything, more or less. He did all the major teaching, all the lecture series, seminars, ceremonies, ordinations, individual communications with people. Yes, of course. He was sparking off other order members who were doing all sorts of things, but there was just him. There was just him at the centre of it all, sparking us off. But he said, it's good, isn't it, that I broke teachers. And then he said, because you have the public and the private preceptor. And it's best if they can be distinct. It's best if your private preceptor is different from your public preceptor. So you've got those two sources, if you like, associated with your ordination. It hasn't always worked like that, but it's best if it can be like that. And even better if you can have two separate Kalyana Mitras. So you've got two other different sources of connection. And of course, there are many outstanding order members communicating the Dharma, teaching the Dharma, who we can have connection with as well, who help us on our way. So there's a lot available to you. But perhaps it's particularly in the context of the ordination ceremony, it's the private and public preceptors who are going to be focusing all that, teaching, if you like. They sort of essentialize it in a certain sort of way. There's another thing he said I found very, very striking, and I'm I'm still pondering it. I really like it. It makes complete sense to me. He said, by loyalty, I mean something really strong. I mean loyalty almost in a feudal sense. You know, that in the sense of its strength, not that we're serfs in relation to the Lord of the Manor. I don't think anybody I've ordained would relate to me in that way, thankfully. But he meant the strength of the bond. I think that is really conveyed by what I was saying earlier on in the talk. The strength of the bond formed in the ordination, because you've been preparing for it, you've been changing through it, and that is seen, that is witnessed, that commitment, that going for refuge is really seen by the order members who know you, and especially the precepts. So this very strong bond of loyalty is formed. With loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. He also said that I'm going to go into unpack the meaning of loyalty in a moment, but I do want to mention another thing that he said. He said, well, loyalty would mean, you know, loyalty of course means it means things like reliability, trust, what's that word I'm looking for? Something heartedness, a real faithful heart in relation to your teachers and so on. And so Bhante did say on one occasion that, yes, it would also mean that you would, if necessary, defend your teachers, your Kalyana Mitras, against criticism. Doesn't mean that you can't criticise them yourself. Doesn't mean that you have to blindly follow them if they're, it's not that you necessarily go along with everything that they say or do, but if they're being publicly attacked, you would hold up their good name. You would stand by them through thick and thin. And I think this is another reason why you really need to think very, very carefully about whether or not you want to be ordained. And think very, very carefully who you'd like your, in choosing your private preceptor, because you are, you know, with that, this word loyalty, you are going to have to stand by them, maybe through thick and thin. We tend to think, when we talk about the teacher, in our very black and white context, that they're always going to be fine. They're not going to get into any difficulty of any kind, and we can just soak it up. They must be highly developed and all the rest of it, and all we've got to do is just soak up the enlightenment. But it's not like that. Not in the context in which we're operating in. Not in any context, actually. Teachers are human beings. Senior order members are human beings. Bhante's a human being. With all sorts of things to contend with of one kind or another. We need to be loyal to that. Loyal to them. Loyal to them through all sorts of difficulties. I was very struck, a story that keeps haunting me. It's a Sufi story from, which is told in many contexts, most famously in Attar's incredible The Conference of the Birds. And it's the story of Sheikh Sanan. So Sheikh Sanan was this great sheikh living in Mecca, had loads of disciples, hugely successful teacher. And what happens? You know, he's got this, you know, after all these decades of, you know, constant meditation on God and all the rest of it, and all the Sufi practices and all these disciples with him, he falls in love with a beautiful Christian maiden. He's so besotted that he just has to go and live with her. But she is really cruel. And so she says, yes, you can live with me, but you have to look after my pigs. And, you know, Muslims and pigs, it's a forbidden, it's haram, you know, you mustn't have anything to do with pigs. But he's so in love, he goes and becomes a sort of a pig farmer. So you can just see this girl who's utterly heartless. And at this point, the disciples who've been loyal up to this point, so we can't help him, and they go back to Mecca. And they bump into another teacher and they tell them their sorrows about how they've been betrayed by their teacher. And he's a pig farmer because he's loved with a Christian, an infidel. You know, the teacher says, and you've left him? you've left him. What sort of disciples are you that you could do that? If you've committed to him, you've actually got to stay with him. He doesn't say, oh yes, you've done the right thing, follow me. No. You've made a bond, you've made a vow, you've got to be with him. So you could think, well, it's a bit stupid, isn't it? But anyway, they go back because this other teacher's also very waiting. Of course, he comes to his senses. The Christian woman converts to Islam and they all live every happily ever after, dissolve into God and all the rest of it. But I was just very, very struck by that emphasis. Perhaps it's overstating it. It's making a point, actually, on all sorts of levels, this particular story. But it's this business of trying to get over the fact that, yes, you might have to stand by your teachers and spiritual friends in times of very, very great difficulty. Very, very great difficulty. Without losing your integrity either. Without losing your sense and your common sense. Without losing your values. A very, very interesting story. I know there are other questions that are probably going through your mind at this point. But, you know, surely you're not advocating blind loyalty, Padmavajra. No, of course I'm not. But it's this business of staying with your teachers and friends through difficulty. It might even be that, at certain times you've got more of a sense of the Dharma life than they have, but they're still your teachers. They've still transmitted the Dharma to you. So I want to conclude this talk by trying to unfold a bit what it means to be loyal to one's teachers. And I want to do this by considering the Gaurava Sutta, the Sutta on Reverence and Respect. Bhante has been drawing our attention to this sutta in Revering and Relying on the Dharma, that very wonderful paper that came out of an interview with Subhuti. And more recently he's had further reflections on the Gaurava Sutta. Actually, he did talk about the Gaurava Sutta a long time ago in the 1980s in a lecture, a wonderful lecture called Discerning the Buddha, where he really reflects on the Gaurava Sutta and Brahma's request, and making the point that if we don't really reflect on the awakening of the Buddha's compassion and the Buddha's experience of the need for reverence, we don't discern the Buddha properly. But in the Gaurava Sutta, of course, you probably remember it's after the Buddha's enlightenment, and he has that extraordinary reflection. He's enlightened, he's woken up to the highest, he sees things as they are, he reflects, it is dukkha, it is suffering, it is painful for a man not to revere another. The word here is Gaurava. And as Bhante points out in his recent reflections, Gaurava doesn't just mean reverence or respect. It also has the meaning of wonder and delight that there is someone higher and greater than you in creativity and spiritual experience. It's related to the words puja and vandana, worship and salutation and veneration. So it's actually a very strong word, Gaurava. It comes from a root meaning weighty, heavy. You revere, you look up to, you worship, you salute that which is weighty with qualities for you, which has really made a deep impression upon you. So the Buddha reflects, it's painful for a man not to be able to revere another. He doesn't just use the word revere. He also uses the word rely on, even to be near and to serve and support. The Pali words have all these connotations from what I've been able to make out. In other words, it's painful not to be a disciple. It's painful not to have a teacher. This is very, very much it's not just, well, Of course, this is a great Indian concern that you have a teacher. But the fact that it's the enlightened man, the newly enlightened man having this reflection, shows that we're dealing with reality. It's the Buddha's insight. It's painful for a man not to revere, rely on, serve, support, be supported by, depend on, is another word, another. It's painful not to be a disciple. It's painful not to have a teacher. Then he considers that there is no one who has surpassed him in morality, meditation, wisdom and liberation. And he comes to the conclusion that he still needs to revere, so he reflects that he will revere and rely on the Dharma. And of course, Bhante explores what is meant by the Dharma in this context. It's not the teaching. There is no teaching at this point. The Buddha hasn't formulated all his sort of teachings and practices. We're talking about reality. We're talking about the way things are. That's what he's going to revere and rely on and serve for the rest of his days. But thinking about this business of the meaning of revering and rely on, I don't think that is a long way away from the word loyalty. Because, of course, with the traditional teaching context, loyalty is taken for granted. If you're a disciple of a teacher, you would be loyal. And you'd be loyal in a number of different ways. And the way I want to explore loyalty is by looking at this teaching called the six Gauravas that Bhante taught in this lecture, Discerning the six different objects of reverence. But I'm going to also call them the six objects of loyalty. They are the Satta, S-A-T-T-H-A, which means the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. Then there's learning or training, the Sikha. Then there's Apramada, or mindfulness, vigilance. And finally, Patisantara, which is very hard to translate. Which I'll have to try and explain that a bit later. But anyway, I'll go through these one by one. But what I want to do in talking like this is I want to talk about how this manifests for me as the expression of my own loyalty to my teacher, to Urgyen Sangharakshita. I want to talk about how I'm loyal, how I try to be loyal to him in relation to these six things. So first of all, there's loyalty to the Sangha, loyalty to the teacher, loyalty to the Buddha. Well, I can be loyal to the Buddha, which is a way of being loyal to my teacher, because of my teacher, because of Bhante. Bhante has introduced me to the Buddha. So being loyal to the Buddha is an expression of my loyalty to Bhante. I've been, I feel, initiated effectively into the life of the Buddha by listening to Bhante talk about the Buddha. I've been in seminars with Bhante on Pali texts. I've listened to lectures where Bhante has told stories from the life of the Buddha. And I feel very strongly that I've been introduced to the Buddha. I feel very, very strongly that the Buddha as a teacher, as the teacher, it's Satta Deva Manusa. This word Satta is only used for the Buddha. It's not used for anybody else in the Buddhist tradition. I really feel through listening to Bhante, studying Bhante, being with Bhante, that the Buddha has been evoked as a teacher, as a living presence. So I feel that an expression of loyalty to Bhante is to constantly recollect the Buddha and make sure that the Dharma that I practice, the Dharma that I communicate, is faithful to the Buddha, faithful to the Buddha as my teacher has evoked him and explained him. There is something really magical about the way Bhante talks about the Buddha. It doesn't mean he's a Theravadi. He loves the Pali Canon, often goes back to the Pali Canon. But the way Bhante talks about the Buddha of the Pali Canon brings alive so much more than you can often find in the dry texts or even in traditional Theravadin expositions. I remember in particular coming up here for an order weekend where Bhante gave that lecture, A Case of Dysentery. I was there. It was an incredible, incredible lecture. It was in the dining room when it was a shrine room. And there was Bhante, and you really felt you were there. You were there with the Buddha and Ananda tending this sick monk. Not only did you have the story, you had Bhante drawing out the teaching from the story, and it's a teaching directly relevant to the order and to the way we treated each other. Really trying to invoke the importance of really caring for each other very, very deeply. And there was so much feeling in the way Bhante was communicating, as well as enormous clarity. Now, I wouldn't have got anywhere near that kind of insight into the Buddha on my own. That's come through my teacher. So I'm loyal to Bhante through, studying what he's, the way he's communicated, the nature of the sutta, the nature of the Buddha. There have been times when I've been with Bhante and it's almost, you think, hang on, were you there, Bhante? Remember one time he talked about the Buddha's early morning, the Buddha's sleep, about the fact that Buddha never slept. He'd just rest. He'd be in this sort of twilight rest. He doesn't need to sleep because there's no effort to stay aware. How does he know? So he just relaxes, and then the devas come in at dawn, and he talks to the devas, and then he sees what to do today, how to teach spontaneously, naturally. So we're sitting in a seminar, and there's Bhante talking like this, and this feeling for what it might be like to be with the Buddha is so palpable. So yes, in being loyal to my teacher, it's being loyal to, meditating on the sutta, the Buddha. Then there is the next object of reverence is the Dharma. So I want to be loyal to Bhante, to my teacher, through really trying to understand deeply his insight into the Dharma. And one of the things I find very striking about Bhante's insight to the Dharma is its transcendental quality, its Lokuttara quality, its the beyond the world quality to it. Very interesting in our group today. A number of people said that their attraction to the order, quite naturally, quite spontaneously, was that the order, I can't remember if they used the word embodied, but the order transmitted the transcendental. I was quite shocked. Quite surprised, sort of restored my faith in the order. Sorry, it's a bit of a joke, but I thought, yes, that really means something. That's it. Very important to have that, as Bhante once said in the 1984 Tuscany, I think it was, that the order is much more than a rather scruffily dressed group of individuals sitting around in a room talking about Buddhism, which we were at the time. Yes, there is something transcendental. And what Bhante's insight into the Dharma is so profound. The transcendental unity of Buddhism. I think a lot of people are very, very shallow in their reading of Bhante. They pick up a few things. They take those things very literally. And they just haven't gone to the depth of his vision as the Dharma, as this universal liberating force, which has manifested in different cultures and contexts and through different teachings and practices and trainings. But there's this deep insight into the Buddhayana, the way of the Buddha, the transcendental unity of the Dharma. Of course, this is manifested particularly in his vision of the refuge tree. You know, what you're doing with all those teachers of the past and you know, from the Buddha and coming right down to Bhante, you're seeing his vision into the transcendental unity of Buddhism, of the Dharma. That Shinran and Buddha Ghosha can be part of this same liberating tradition. Buddha Ghosha, the great Theravadin Acharya, Shinran, the one who lives through complete faith in Amitabha. Bhante is saying there is a deep sense in which this is the same Dharma, even though there are very different manifestations. You can't just read Bhante saying that in the survey or something like that and think, oh yeah, transcendental unity of Buddhism, understand that, get that. No, you have to meditate on it. You have to see. You have to go down deeply into it. It's actually beyond words. Yes, you have the form of the great teachings like Pratityasamutpada and so on and so forth, but you can only know it directly and sense it. Not intuitive, all these words just don't really apply. But that's what he's getting at. I was very, very struck in his lecture on being all things to all men, where he's expounding the skillful means of the Bodhisattva and the first of the Pratisamvids, the Dharma Pratisamvid, the analytical knowledge of reality. And he says it's a direct, conceptless realization of the Dharma, and particularly the sense that all the jhanas are tending in the end to the full realization of Buddhahood. But direct, not an idea, something with you all the time. So when I think of loyalty to my teacher, I think of, well, I need to be loyal to realizing this. It's not loyalty to a dogma. The loyalty is to practice, to realize this. And then the next object of reverence is the Sangha. So what about loyalty to my teacher in the sense of Sangha? Well, again, Bhante's vision of the Sangha is astonishingly profound. Yes, it's of the Arya Sangha. The Sangha, the transcendental Sangha, that's the real Sangha that you go for refuge to. It's the Sangha, yes, of the great Arahants and Bodhisattvas. It's the Sangha, particularly as expressed through the image of the 11-headed and 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara, the third order of consciousness. We've got all these names for it. But this sense of transcending the individual and the many. Individuals in complete harmony, animated by compassion for the benefit of all. That's the Sangha that, you know, these ideas all and insights all come from Bhante. So of course, in being loyal to Bhante, I want to realize that in all the kind of untidiness and messiness of life in the order, on the ground, so to speak. That's what I feel I'm being asked to do in being loyal to my teacher. And practically, it's this tremendous vision of the order, of being of a unified order, that we're neither monk nor lay. Again, it's one of those things that trip off the tongue and we think we know what it means. We don't know what it means. It doesn't mean that, actually I think a lot of people think effectively the way they practice it is that they're basically laymen. What he means by lay is part-time, not really living it through in absolutely everything that you do. Regardless of your, that's what going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha means. You're living out your Dharma life in absolutely everything. You're going for refuge in everything, regardless of your social status, your ecclesiastical status, so to speak. You are just a Dharmachari or Dharmacharini, and you're meeting in and through that. And there's no appeal to special status. I can't say to you that I'm a better Dharmachari than you because I live in a men's community and I'm supported full time. That doesn't come into it. And you can't say if you're living with your family, oh, well, those teachings are off limits. I don't have anything to do with those because I'm a layman. No, that's a cop out. You can't do that. You have to meet in and through your total commitment to the Dharma life. So you have a Mahasangha, in other words, a great spiritual community made up of those who go for refuge and practice the 10 precepts. So in being loyal to, Bhante, my teacher, I want to realise this, practice this in everything that I do. And then the next Gaurava is you revere the Sikha, the Shiksha. You revere your learning, your training. Traditionally, this is revering your ethics, your meditation, your wisdom. In other words, you're revering the general Buddhist training. But here, within our context, I feel that in being loyal to Bhante, I'm practicing the system of spiritual training that he's transmitted to me and to many of us. So those great stages of the spiritual path, you know, integration or mindfulness, positive emotion, the Brahma Viharas, spiritual death and insight and vision, realization of shunyata in spiritual death, and then spiritual rebirth through the constant meditation on the chosen bodhisattva. And yes, the whole atmosphere of spiritual receptivity and spontaneous compassionate activity, the end of the path, training in that. So being loyal to Bhante is continually practicing that, being faithful to that, not because it's a chore, but because it's liberating, because I've tasted what it can do, because it's giving me the actual foundation of my Dharma life. I can go anywhere with that training. We could even mention here the 10 precepts. The way Bhante has communicated the 10 precepts, so you only have to read the 10 pillars of Buddhism, shows that the 10 precepts that we follow comprise the whole of the Dharma, the whole of the path, because they're precepts for body, speech and mind. Body, speech and mind. Even the way he expounds the first precept. To really practice the first precept, you need to have insight. I mean, it really is extraordinary these days, people talking about, their insights into not-self and all the rest of it. They do far better to read and study and develop insight into Bhante's exposition of the first precept in the 10 pillars. You know, where he talks about, if you really want to practice the first precept, if you really want to practice love, you have to transcend self and other. You have to see through self and other. You have to be living for others. And there's this wonderful quotation he has from Shantideva, as well as Shelley, the arts come in as well. It's another great feature of Bhante's teaching, the emphasis on the arts and the sensibility that comes from that. So in being loyal to Bhante, loyalty to my teacher means practicing the trainings that he's transmitted, understanding them theoretically, and living them out in practice fully. So many things I could also mention, the contexts that he's given us, things like men's retreat centres, like this one. Well, it comes from Bhante, you know, that vision of things, which I personally feel within this context I can fly dharmically. It's a training to be in this context. Then the next of the Gauravas is that you revere is apramada, mindfulness or vigilance. So you revere mindfulness. Of course, Bhante is an incredibly mindful person. The most mindful person I've ever met, being around Bhante. You really get a sense of mindfulness as a sort of force. That's what I felt being around him. It's not like, you know, being up there and, you know, trying to kind of be in your body and watch what you're doing. You feel that you're with this big consciousness, this big awareness. But in his lecture on this, he said that what mindfulness really represents is are the spiritual qualities that you're trying to develop. A very interesting idea. You revere, you respect the spiritual qualities that you're trying to develop. So, you know, before you do the metta bhavana, for example, it's a good idea to evoke the archetype of metta, if you like, within your mind and revere it. You often get this in the Buddhist text. They talk about the qualities, the benefits of a particular quality, so that you're really inspired to meditate on that quality. So one of the things I feel about being loyal to Bhante, to my teacher, is to especially work on developing the qualities that he's particularly emphasized in Buddhist practice. Of course, there are so many. But perhaps primary among them, and perhaps most practically important, is friendship. Again, recently he's written another piece on friendship. He seems to be very, very productive in his final years. A beautiful piece on friendship. Good friends, bad friends, and spiritual friends. I'm one of the reasons why I'm a disciple of Bhante, why I'm so grateful to him, is his emphasis on metta, his emphasis on loving kindness, his emphasis on love, and how that needs to be expressed in making friends with people. In practical ways, just going out to people and befriending them, and to meet in friendship, and to do everything you can to deepen the friendships you have and extend your range of friendships. You know, this whole Bodhisattva path that he's also initiated into is really expanding friendships. And of course, it's through friendship that the Dharma is really transmitted. So I want to be loyal to Bhante by practicing friendship, by being a good friend to people, in the same way that people have befriended me. One of the things that I look at, when I look back at my order life, is how I've been befriended by order members. The first order member I met, Buddhadasa, befriended me. Befriended me by giving me the Dharma very, very powerfully. Other order members at that time, my other Kalyanamitra, Visantara, befriended me, encouraged me, clarified things, for me. I was such a whippersnapper, so naive, so wet behind the ears, as we say. But they took me seriously. They took my aspiration seriously. And there are many other order members I could mention. Lokamitra, Subhuti, I mean, meeting those guys in the early days, there was electricity coming off those guys. They were like these sort of generators, kind of buzzing, and you just kind of caught it, and you wanted to go out and save the world when you met those guys. It was just extraordinary, the energy coming from them. And of course, Bhante himself. When I think of my ordination, I feel I've had the most essential and profound, I've been in receipt of the most essential and profound of form of spiritual friendship I could imagine. Essentialized Dharma, not just in the words and in the teachings at the time of my ordination, and he did teach, he took us through the shepherd's search for mind, but something that I really can't put into words. Perhaps that transcendental element, any word doesn't really apply, but something very, very pure, which is still alive and continues to grow and continues to animate me and continues to open up adventure. That's another big reason for coming into the order, wanting to be an order member. Adventure, fun, expansion. A very, very strong force of something or other that Bhante transmitted. And one reflection I've had on it is to do this business of witnessing. We say that in ordination you're going for refuge is witnessed, and it's witnessed by somebody you respect or you revere. And when you're witnessed, it means that your aspiration, you're going for refuge, is being taken completely seriously. So what happens when the man you most revere, in this case for me, Bhante, witnesses you're going for refuge, takes you're going for refuge completely seriously, more seriously than you take it yourself? Well, stuff happens. Things are unleashed. Forces are invoked. But that's I often think if it was nothing else, if there was just that, it would be more than enough. More than enough. So I want to be loyal to that friendship. I want to be loyal by repaying what Bhante gave me and taking me completely seriously and living from that as fully as possible. The final object of reverence is Patisantara, which is very, very hard to translate. It can mean a friendly welcome. It can mean friendship. It comes from a root meaning a spread, like a banquet laid out. And Bhante in the original lecture says, well, he thinks it means is that you revere the great spread of the Dharma. I certainly feel that Bhante has just laid out this massive banquet of Dharma for me to gorge myself on. Perhaps a rather vulgar image there, but never mind. But I'm also reminded of Shantideva in the Bodhicharavatara, in talking about the bodhicitta, or not just talking, but speaking from the depths of bodhicitta. It seems the bodhicitta has arisen in him. And he talks about the bodhicitta as a great banquet of happiness spread out for everybody to come to. I invite the world to Buddhahood and to all the happiness of the Dharma. So just inviting people in. So I suppose this Patisantara idea I associate with bodhicitta. I'm a disciple of Bhante, a loyal disciple of Bhante, because he's transmitted to me the bodhicitta. I remember one of the earliest lectures I ever heard, The Arising of the Bodhi Heart, completely electrified me. I think it was on a reel-to-reel tape recorder in a house in Preston Park near Brighton. Patrick knows where I'm talking about. Terry too, probably. And hearing Bhante talk about the bodhicitta as not being contained in the skandhas, the anywhere in conditioned existence. It's nobody's personal possession. It's not a thought about enlightenment. Bodhicitta is not a good name for bodhicitta. It's more like this sort of force that of wisdom and compassion that erupts in you, that erupts through you. Later on he talked about it erupting within a community so that you just work for the Dharma, for the good of all beings, inspired, moved by this bodhicitta. So in being loyal to my teacher, I want to live for and from that bodhicitta with my brothers and sisters in the Dharma. So I've tried to talk about the way I see being loyal to my teachers means, and why I'm in this order. I could have given another kind of talk, but fortunately we've got other speakers to bring out other things, better things. But this is what loyalty means to me. It's being loyalty being loyal to what I've been given, really living that out. The teacher has always been incredibly important to me as a sort of archetype. It was one of the reasons why I got into the Dharma. I'm always very, very moved by hearing about teachers and disciples. You know, very early on, I read Lama Govinda and read the life of Milarepa. And I'm just incredibly grateful to have such a wonderful teacher. It's taken me, you know, time to really begin to realise more fully the extent of what Bhante's given me. And to realise that I have much to do to be fully loyal to him as a teacher and to his teaching. But I feel that's getting clearer. I want to end with Milarepa, actually. A song of Milarepa, which when I first encountered, I was very moved by. Milarepa's in retreat. He's struggling a bit. He longs to see Marpa. Marpa comes in a vision and encourages him to practice. It's called To See My Father Guru's Face. This is, of course, loyalty to a teacher at an extremely high level that I couldn't possibly aspire to, but I just wonder at this kind of level of practice and devotion. To see my Father Guru's face and hear his voice transforms this beggar's sorrow into the heart's inspiration. Recollecting the Guru's kindness, devotion dawns deep within my heart. Blessings and kindness directly enter me. All destructive thoughts are banished. Though this lamenting song recalling you might annoy you, know that this beggar sorrows in the darkness, filled with loss and longing to see your face. So, my Guru, protect and sustain me with your kindness. Blazing meditation, born of heartfelt perseverance, is my service to please you, Father Guru. Wandering the wilderness alone is my service to please the Dakinis. Selfless practice of the Dharma is my service to the Buddha's teachings. Uniting life and meditation is my gift to helpless fellow beings. To strive in life through happiness and sorrow is the broom that sweeps away karma and the defilements. The fortitude of living on nettles is the basis for transcendental realization. I shall repay my Father Guru's kindness through constant meditation. Nurture me with kindness, Supreme Guru. Bless this beggar to succeed in his hermit's isolation.